Remember anything.
Well, hi there, Brogan. It's me, your podcast co-host, Murph. We're on the Daydream Cast.
I don't know you at all.
Oh, you always were a kidder, Brogan. You come on. Don't you remember last episode when you agreed to doing an episode on Harvester?
That seems wildly irresponsible and something I wouldn't do. That seems really out of character.
No, that's very much in your character as a kidder, Brogan. Which you always were. But before we get to the meat of this episode, how about you tell me about some games you've been playing in a segment we on the podcast called the Daydream Cast call What You Play In?
You know what? You're right. I'm just going to sit down and talk about it. Guys, I played Balatro, and this is such a fun game. Oh my gosh. I've played games that experimented with poker hands before. I think there was an itch.io game, it may have been by the same developer, that did like blackjack but with unique poker hands and stuff. It was more utilized where you could mix into the deck itself, but this game is much more just essential poker hands with your deck, and you can add cards to your deck with special attributes, and then you have special other cards that influence the score of your poker hand. So you have joker cards, which essentially give you different effects that make things, you know, either wild cards or add to a multiplier or additional numbers or a bunch of other effects. And then there's tarot cards and celestial cards. It's all super fun. What ends up happening is that you go through a run. It's sort of very rogue-ish in that you're trying to build a deck on the fly. Every time you go to the store, you see how much money you have. You plan to buy things and sort of make your build spontaneously. And it's really, really fun. I would highly recommend
it. I feel like this is the Vampire Survivors of this year, because it's like the indie game that seemingly everyone is playing and can't stop talking about how much they're playing it. You know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think I had problems with Vampire Survivor. I still love the game. But I think Vampire Survivor didn't have a lot of meat to it. I think it was very like dopamine number go up. I feel like this game teaches you strategy and how probability works as you play. The more you play, the better you get, which is really important to me for a game, and it was really, really valuable. There were times where I started and I was just trying to get to meet the score, and I was like, wow, these cards seem kind of useless. And then, like, you know, fast forward, you know, hours in, I'm like, oh no, these cards are actually really, really good, so I can get this hand, so I can like just triple what I was making in terms of score output. So I feel like there's a skill element to it that's really satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Like you're learning the game's language and then mastering that.
Yeah, and I mean, there's still probability, but the probability is within your control, especially as you get later on in the antes. And the antes themselves also offer unique things. Like, you know, basically you'll have a small ante, which you get a little bit of coins for, a big ante, and then after the round, there's a boss, quote-unquote, ante, which has you have a handicap. And the handicap can get quite challenging, depending. Like, your entire run can be ruined by the RNG of a tough boss ante, but you can also control that probability as well. So it's all very thick.
Does it tell you the probability, or are you calculating the cards in your head?
What do you mean?
So, I really got into Poker Night at the Inventory, which is, you know, just regular old poker with some video game and comic book characters. But I don't know why I became hyper fixated on calculating the chance of getting the hand I wanted in my head. And I was never quite good at it, but I would always have a stack of scratch paper where I'd be like, oh, I have a king and a queen right now. What are the odds that a jack will be drawn in the river?
Okay.
You know, stuff like all that. Right,
I can answer this. The answer is you won't be thinking of that very
okay.
much. Here's what's actually going to happen. Okay, so the big thing is this is not like a Texas Hold'em. Like, that probability matters way more when you play Texas Hold'em with other people. And you've got two cards in front of you, and the river's like, oh, this, this, and this. And then you have to figure out what are my chances of actually making that straight or,
yes.
or three of a kind or whatever. That's not actually what's happening in this game. What's going to happen is you're playing by yourself. You're not playing against anyone else. You have to have a certain score. You have to meet a score by the end of, like, five hands.
Mm.
And you get, like, 10 cards from your deck. More like 7. It's like 7 cards from your deck you pull. You can discard some and get new ones, but there's only a certain amount of that you can do. And then you play a hand. So you're looking out at your 7 cards, and you're like, well, I can play a straight. And then with the straight and the multipliers, you get, say, 700 points for that hand. And that means I have 2 hands to go, and I need to make 1,200 points. And that's how the game is played.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very different. There are ways to calculate probability, and when probability matters, it will tell you, specifically with the jokers. Like, for instance, there could be a joker that's like, 1 in 3 times you put down an 8 or whatever, you will get a multiplier. So in that, you'll know the probabilities there. And it won't matter so much. And you can also, like, look at your hands. Like, you can look at, number one, the deck you have itself and what you've played in that round. And you can also look at your most played hands, which do matter. Like, there are some jokers that give you multipliers for not playing your your most played hands. Does that make sense?
Huh. Yeah, okay. I can definitely see. Because I'm just on the outside looking in as far as this game's presence on social media right now. And all I'm just seeing is, like, people posting pictures of pixel poker hands and being like, oh my god, this is the best I've ever done, you know. Okay, I can definitely see how that would be addictive. Does it feel like it's something that would have a long tail on it? Or once you've surmounted it, it's surmounted and you're kind of done with it?
The game doesn't have, like, a lot of crazy content. What happens is you play it. I have beaten one cycle of it, and it's not like there's crazy new cycles on top of cycles, but instead you'll get new Joker cards, and then you'll get new decks. And the decks, or, there's also little chip challenges, sort of restrict the game in separate ways. So, for instance, the first deck I won a game with was one where it included money for the extra discards I have. So in that game, I just never discarded so I could get extra money. And I beat it. I was like, oh, this is super easy. This is great. And then I unlocked more decks. And then I looked at all the other decks. And you could go to a different one that has a different handicap or a different bonus. And then for the one I just played, that deck one or whatever, there's an extra chip thing that means that I have one less extra hand per round. And stuff like that increases the challenge and allows you to familiarize yourself with the game even more, and allows you to appreciate its depth. Because I do think poker as a game of probability and hand playing mixed with the deck building of this game is a very satisfying experience.
Hmm. You know what's another game you're going for big combos in?
What's up?
Tekken 8.
There you go, Murph. You have played Tekken 8. And Murph, can you tell the listener what main you have?
Well, I mean, you just have to think about the characters I played in Street Fighter VI and sort of extrapolate from there the kind of archetype, you know. And that archetype...
Is the archetype a big, meaty woman?
No.
Is it a small grappler that can jump in the air a lot?
No, the archetype is characters named Lily.
There you go. That's a unique archetype. So you play Lily in Tekken. What have you learned about Tekken?
So I've mentioned before, I like Tekken. I've never really tried to go in on it. I had Tekken 5 back on the PS2 back in the day, and I, like, beat every character's story mode. which I consider a badge of honor because Jinpachi is, like, one of the most busted final bosses of a fighting game ever. But as far as, like, trying to actually learn the system and do combos, I actually found Tekken's a lot more forgiving for that than I think I ever really gave it credit for. Especially with this one, because, and I know some hardcore Tekken fans are upset about this, but there's not a lot of, like, the crazy Tekken movement tech present in this. Or at the very least, it's not there at the ranks I'm playing at. A lot of moves tracks, particularly grabs, so you're not doing the whole... It feels more like a 2.5D fighter most of the time, rather than something where you're juking out of the way constantly.
Absolutely. I feel like what's really cool about Tekken, as I've played, is it is probably the best fighting game to engage at on any any technical level. Like a spectator could watch it, fall in love. A new player can play it, fall in love. And in terms of depth, there is like an infinite pool of depth. I think there are a lot of people online who complain about the changes from Tekken 7. But that being said, I think this is a fantastic game.
Yeah, and I think the way it teaches you to play the game and particularly get better are some really engaging, useful tools. And I said that about Street Fighter VI as well, and it's interesting that they have very different kind of tool sets, whereas like Street Fighter VI's labbing mode is really in-depth and useful. It will tell you like the exact frame data and everything. Like, oh, here's the startup frames, here's the invulnerability frames, here's where you have an active hitbox. You know, that sort of stuff. Whereas with Tekken, it will sort of... The ghost system and the ability to watch replays of your matches, and it will give you insight like, oh, you could have done a punish there with this move, or you could have extended this combo with this set, and then you can drop yourself back into that moment and practice it. But beyond that, the super ghost battles, as they're called, where it will study your fighting style and make an AI CPU fighter built around that, so you can practice against yourself and see where your flaws are. But you can also download other players' ghosts. So I use that a lot for warm-ups when I'm heading into a ranked match, because, you know, in other fighting games, when you're fighting against the CPU, it's fighting how the CPU is programmed to. It's not really fighting like a person, and therefore you can pick up a lot of bad habits. Like, CPUs are really bad about, like, teching throws and stuff in Street Fighter.
Or they can read inputs. So a lot of times their reactions are inhuman, or they also don't hold charge. And
that just gives you a better experience of like fighting a human person and seeing like what kind of tactics there are. It will give you a lot of familiarity with the kind of like cheese some characters are capable of. I went up against a Reyna ghost who just did her low spinning kick move over and over again. And after I lost to that a few times, I'm like, okay, I can see the windup now. I know to block low, and I know what I have that's a punish for that. Because Lily has a lot of low kicks that can come in and get a combo started, especially on punish. And that was just really invigorating to learn. And I have been practicing and getting out the big meaty Tekken combos where you carry someone to the other side of the screen and delete their health bar. And I find a lot of it actually isn't that much of a mental stack as I had built it up to be. In a lot of ways, it's kind of like remembering the lyrics to your favorite song, where, you know, you're kind of like, a long, long time ago, I can still remember how the music used to make me smile, and and I knew if I had that chance, I could make those people dance, you know? And
the secret to a fighting game combo, especially in Tekken, is it's components, right? And then you can mix the components together. It's like, oh, after this I can launch, and then after this I can do this, and then this, and then it's a matter of what's optimal or what you want to do. Like, do you want to carry them across the screen, or do you want to do as much damage as possible?
And Tekken's also just a good game for learning fundamentals. Like, I've gotten by on Lily's fundamentals pretty good. She has her down forward four, which is a kick that initially hits mid and then she stomps really quick for a low, and most players don't block that, and that puts you in plus, and you can easily follow that up with a grab. So yes, I am playing another character named Lily that is a 50-50 mix-up for a grab.
You're like, wow, this is my ideal.
This is a Unix system. I know this.
Yeah. It's just a Lily archetype, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So Murph, I have played Crypt Stalker.
Tell me about these crypts that you stalk. Tell me some of these tales from the crypt.
Tales from, straight out of the crypt. Crazy motherfucker named Brogan. No. Crypt Stalker is basically like a Castlevania-like. Pavlo sent this to me and showed this to me because he was like, you like Castlevania, you like retro games. He sometimes will like ping me in our Discord, be like, yo, check
did
this
he, game. Did he phrase it by saying, so I see you like to play Castlevania.
Yes, in a German accent. Yes. Yes, he did. What I like about Crypt Stalker is it kind of is what I want out of an indie game that is trying to be another game. You know, I went to PAX East a couple weeks ago, and I played this game. I think it's called Transylvania, The Adventure of Simon Quest.
Yes.
And you're familiar with
this? Yeah, I think you brought it up on your PAX East.
I did bring it up on my PAX East, and that's a game where it is so impossibly Castlevania. Like, if you were not hiding under parody and like the artistic license of mechanics and vague aesthetics, that you could be like, oh, this is close to plagiarism. I'm not saying that's literal. I'm saying that it plays too much like Castlevania for it to feel new and fresh.
Yeah.
I think Crypt Stalker has, you know, it's the I would say its biggest Castlevania influence, and this is going to sound so fucking weird, is the Game Boy Castlevanias. Not the Game Boy Advance Metroidvanias. I'm talking like the Game Boy Castlevanias. And even then, the look and feel of it is still uniquely itself, even if you're doing similar things and there's similar elements. There's some Ninja Gaiden in there. There's some Bionic Commando in there too. And there's a lot of extra content they've added to this package with extra levels and an extra like Game Boy mode that is meant to resemble the Game Boy Castlevanias. So I feel like there's a little bit more of an inspired element to this. And I really enjoyed the game.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the Steam page right now, and there's literally a screenshot where you can apply what looks to be a Game Boy Gray filter to it.
Absolutely. That is part of the point. And it's crazy cheap. It is like $3. It is super fun. I feel like some of the elements of it can sometimes border on recolors depending on the stage. Sometimes the themed stages don't really pop. But I feel like there is a good gameplay variety. The gameplay is forgiving but rewarding. And I also like how it does its sub-weapon system, where you can swap a bit, like you can have like this extra projectile thing, and the projectile thing sort of operates like a Contra or a Metal Slug, where you're getting different ammo types, and the different ammo types I have a spread, or there's a rocket that explodes, stuff like that. So again, it's not just a straight Castlevania clone where, you know, oh, you have a cross that goes forward and comes back, or you have an axe that goes up in a trajectory. This is sort of its own thing at points, which is really, really fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It is nifty. It's interesting to me that, and I'm trying to think of Mina the Hollower is another one. We're getting these, they're 8-bit revivals, but they're specifically like the Game Boy 8-bit era and a little bit of like the Sega Game Gear, you know, where it's these super more like tight frames and visuals while still keeping that Game Boy aesthetic.
You know, rewind, I would say 5 years ago, and I think we never evolved beyond NES retro revivals / like a little bit up to like 32-bit.
Mm-hmm.
But now, I think the future of retro-ish inspired indie games is really PS1 aesthetics and slash, like, you know, that era, and Game Boy, exactly, because Game Boy is also so simple and effective, and that really forces people to play in certain ways. Like, there's a Void Stranger is another similar one where the Game Boy elements are so minimal,
mm-hmm.
and the minimalism really helps, and it doesn't hinder anything in terms of art style or anything else. I just love it. It's great.
Yeah. Speaking of forcing the player to play in a specific way, I've been playing some of that there Dragon's Dogma 2, The Dark Arises Once More.
Let me preface this with some things. Number one, I'm playing Dragon's Dogma 1. I was like, I need to play Dragon's Dogma 1 before I play Dragon's Dogma 2. And then last episode, Tucker came in and was like, poo-pooing it. I don't know your opinion yet, Murph. But Brendan messaged me and he's like, we got to do an episode on Dragon's Dogma. So one day, at the very least, there will be a person that comes in and sing Dragon's Dogma 2's praises. Because I know Brendan fucking loves the game.
Mm-hmm.
But Merv, how did you feel about it?
So I never played the original, though I hear it talked about a lot because it's one of them cult classics, you know. And all I really know is that there's something called a pawn system. There's big enemies you can crawl over, like Shadow of the Colossus, and the NPCs repeat the same dialogue ad nauseum to the point you find it endearing or frustrating. I don't really know, with that in mind, I don't really know what Dragon's Dogma 2 has changed up, really, because all of that still seems to hold true. I think... So I'll set aside, like, the stuff about friction and games. I'm not really prepared to dip my toe in there just quite yet. I'll say I find the combat flashy, I like the class system and skills, and I find the pawn system intriguing, though I feel it's a case of they don't go as all in as they probably should have with the pawns. And that ties to my greater issue with the game, is that I just don't find the writing or world compelling whatsoever. This is a very run-of-the-mill fantasy setting for me, and all the characters talk in these very thick Cockney British accents, and it's a lot of these and thous and prithees and ought. There's a lot of saying ought. There ought to be done. I don't see ought of him. I think there's aught over there. And that's, you know, on paper, that's not my hang-up. I read Shakespeare for fun. Whatever. It's more in the performance, because not all actors know how to read that kind of dialogue and make it sound natural, you know? You know, it's like a high school play. Some people know what they're saying. Others are just repeating lines they have memorized, you know? And I think there's a lot of... and this ties into what I feel about the pawns, because the pawns talk a lot. They talk a lot, and it's a lot of the same lines of like, oh, I think there's a boulder over there. Methinks 'twould fall over if we all push on it, you know. And I just kind of want to slap them and be like, you don't talk like that. Stop, Sandra. We know you took like a year long trip in the UK. That's not your real voice, you know.
How much of this leads into charm?
It's charming. It was charming initially, but I think there's too many major NPCs that I've talked to that just don't sell it for me. Like, initially, the opening is pretty cool. You're in this, like, work camp, and then a Medusoid attacks, and you escape with one of the pawns on the back of a griffin. But that pawn you escape with is just, like, the most dry, he wasn't given context for the line reads, like, oh, I think we should jump, Arisen. Better take it with the seas than with the guards, you know? It just does nothing for me. And the pawns themselves only have four personality types: simple, straightforward, calm, and kind-hearted. And of those, they only have two voices, technically. They have a female voice and a male voice, and then those voices are pitch shifted to create different voices. But it's all the same voice actress, voice actor, and line reads, just slightly different tones. And it's like, okay, where's, like, I don't know, the jackass Pawn personality? Where's, like, the weirdly morbid Pawn personality? I feel like I need at least 10 different Pawn personalities to really, like, get a feeling like, oh, when I'm swapping out a Pawn, that's a major decision. I'm getting a whole new person brought in. And it's not, because so many people are making their Pawns either kind-hearted or straightforward, that I'm not that I'm just hearing the same dialogue over and over again. And it's just, it doesn't do much to actually immerse me in that world. And it does, in a lot of ways, it does kind of make me think of those tech demos I see, where it's like, oh, Ubisoft has this new program where you can have a real conversation with an AI. And the example is saying something like, hello, AI NPC, how do you feel about burgers? And the NPC going, I like burgers quite a bit. I think burgers are a good thing, you know? It just, the writing doesn't pop or sing, and it doesn't make me feel like I need to explore this world. Honestly, what's sticking in my brain regarding the discourse around Dragon's Dogma 2 right now is kind of the same thing that I've been working towards playing through the Yakuza series. And a couple episodes back, I was talking about how people talk about Yakuza's open world versus an open world from an Ubisoft game, and I'm finding a lot of the same things here, where I'll see a glowing review of Dragon's Dogma 2 and being where it's like, the world is a joy to explore. Around every corner, you're going to find a little cave or a treasure chest or something. And then compare that to the last 10 years of discourse around any given Ubisoft game. And I hate that I keep coming to the defense of Ubisoft, because their corporate culture is genuinely abhorrent. But this genuinely bugs me when it comes to games discourse. But, you know, when we talk about Ubisoft games and, oh, it's just copy-pasted content all over the place, it's 1,000 meaningless objectives. And I don't see how that's not how Dragon's Dogma 2 is, because, you know, I'm still in the initial area, but I've seen some late-game gameplay, and it's just still more forests and mountainsides for the environments, and it's the same cave designs and, you know, the same treasure chests that you genuinely don't get that much interesting loot from. So I'm just not really feeling that sense of, ooh, around every turn I may find something interesting. What I'm really looking for are those interesting big monster boss fights. But at this stage, I've killed like 5 minotaurs, 7 cyclopses, a chimera, and got halfway to killing a dragon before it flew off. And so it's just not giving me enough new stuff to really get that dopamine loop going as much as it is for other people. And I'm 15 hours in, maybe it'll get better down the line.
This sounds all like what Tucker was trying to say last time around. So, and Brendan felt pretty upset about that. So I think this is going to be an ongoing discussion throughout the year. I have yet to fall down with an opinion on it. I think Brendan found himself very engaged with the world, at least with how its combat and systems interweave. And I think a lot of the new stuff with Dragon's Dogma 2 has to do with the classes themselves and how the classes function for the player character. So stuff like that is definitely worth looking at. I mean, I think there's been an increase in fantasy titles over this period of time. I think when Dragon's Dogma 1 came out, it was probably more novel. And now it's like, we've been here before, at least in terms of that. But I've seen unique monster designs. Like, the Sphinx looks super fucking cool in Dragon's Dogma 2. So I don't know where I'm going to land on it. I'm curious, did you beat the game?
No, not yet. I am 15 hours in.
How long is this game?
People say if you know where to go and what to do, it's really short, even compared to the first one. But the world itself is huge. And so getting into that with, like, the friction of traversal. Honestly, a lot of the stuff that's like quote unquote friction doesn't bug me all that much. The fact that items in your inventory can spoil, that doesn't bother me, because the items that are spoiling are freaking everywhere. Your scrag of beast spoiled, just go shoot a deer. They're everywhere, you know. To me, actually, the biggest issue is the encounter rate. Like, there was a mission I was doing earlier today where I was escorting a guy to a location, and, you know, he was like, oh, we got to get there, you know, within a day, or else, because the quests are time sensitive, you know, we got to get there within a day, or else the thing I need to go there to do will have been over. And so I'm booking it to get there, and I'm just like, every 30 seconds, I am running into another pack of goblins, another pack of wolves, another pack of goblins, some saurians, and then another pack of goblins. And I kind of feel like if this was done as, you know, a JRPG with random overworld encounters, you wouldn't mind that encounter rate so much. I've been playing Might and Magic 6 on the back burner because I'm going to be doing an episode with Brendan on that down the line, and I don't mind the encounter rate there being high so much, just because it's presented in that old school RPG way. I think the issue comes from Dragon's Dogma wanting to be in this aesthetic of the fantasy open world, like living world simulation, where it just feels weird that there are these just armies of goblins wandering around, you know, just everywhere, just a million goblins everywhere. And honestly, playing the game, what I'm feeling most of all is, man, I'd like to go back and finish that last playthrough of Dragon Age Inquisition I started. Because it's a...
Or Baldur's Gate. I think a lot of your problems here aren't going to happen Baldur's Gate.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because that's a different kind of game overall. That's a CRPG. Yeah. And this is...
Yeah, I'm talking about in terms of, like, writing.
Yes.
I think writing is where CRPGs really shine. And I don't think this game has a priority. Like, I guess that's the one defense that I really have is like, I don't know how much they cared about your...
So, it's a game about where the... The story you, the player, are coming up with is the compelling part. Like, you're supposed to come back to your friends and say, like, man, I did this crazy shit in Dragon's Dogma 2. And I have done some crazy shit. There was, like, a thing where there was a chimera down in this this lake bed. And I kind of fell down onto some ruins and provoked it. And my party went in to fight it. But because I was high up on the ruins and I was an archer, I could safely snipe its heads while they distracted it. And then, like, it came and charged me and knocked me off, but I landed on its back and delivered the killing blow. That's, like, a cool, organic moment. But it's also... I think it truly is if the respawn rate for enemies was lower and I had more just, like, treks through the world, just kind of admiring the forest locale and things, and, you know, kind of, I don't know, dwelling on my thoughts in the way some other open-world games do, then I think I would find it more compelling, but right now it just feels like a game that's entirely being sold on its dynamic combat.
But you can ignore the encounters, right?
You can run past them, but they sometimes blockade you or ambush you, or your pawns will go off and attack them even though they're on super low health, you know? Or they'll follow you around. So you kind of have to do it, and combat's pretty quick, especially against most of the early game enemies. I think the game just probably has a real slow start, and I haven't been progressing past the opening area all that much. Like, I've been to the arbor where the elves are, and it's kind of neat there that the elves all speak a language you don't, so unless you have a translator with you, you can't, like, choose items in the shop and know if you're getting a good deal or not. Like, that's a neat idea, but it's kind of one of those things where I kind of... Again, like the pawn personalities, I wish there was more of it all about. You know, what, you know, have some merchants in the main hub town have that thing. Well, have there be a ton of different languages, and I kind of have to think more about what pawns I want, what languages they speak. You know, for all the talk of, like, the friction in the game and how it doesn't hold the player's hand, honestly, I feel like it kind of holds the player's hand a little more than they probably intended to. So, I don't know. I'll stick with it. I'll see it through to the end, because I hear it does get better once you're outside that starting area and once you're really much more familiar with the world. But right now, I think the issue is that, like, the narrative itself doesn't compel me. It's a decent enough podcast game. But, yeah, I just kind of can't help but feel I'm tired of hearing the word ought and twill and twould.
Twould thou liketh to go to the Variety Minute?
Yeah.
Hey there, everybody. This is Editor Bro here, and this is my fifth time recording this segment here because it is so difficult to convey the words properly here. Basically, this is a precautionary disclaimer because this week's Variety Minute is on controversial video games, because Harvester is a controversial video game. And basically, I just wanted to put this in here to sort of prepare the listener. I don't think Murph or I say anything crazy controversial or offensive. I feel like if there was anything, we didn't say enough on the subject. There was even pickup audio by Murph, because I feel like we focused on some things and not others. Realized that we had limited amount of time and we didn't get to everything. I think if we were to go back, we would talk more about taste and whether or not it's harmful to do or to say shocking things for the sake of drawing distasteful audiences. I think Murph touches on that in the pickup audio. But otherwise, I mean, just understand that we did not dedicate an hour and a half to this conversation. We dedicated 15 minutes, if that. So, you know, if you don't want to listen to it, just skip ahead to the next timestamp where we talk about Harvester. I mean, I still think it's an insightful discussion either way. So, with that, see you guys. This week's Variety Minute is controversial games. Now, Murph, what's your take on controversial games? I don't know how else to say that.
Oh, my.
We got quite a bit here, and there's like a spread, but I feel like, because we're both comic readers, I feel like a lot of controversy over censorship is bad. I would say almost all of it is bad and is harmful to expression and the First Amendment and creativity. And like, especially looking at the early examples of controversy, it's kind of harmless and really sort of shows how quaint things were, or, you know, how strict or Puritan things were fucking even 30 years ago, you know? Like, imagine getting upset over Night Trap.
Night Trap being one of the games that led to the creation of the ESRB will always be funny and a massive L for the U.S. government, because if you watch Night Trap now, you can make 5 edits, I'm going to say, and turn that into a Goosebumps episode, you know?
It's kind of ridiculous and silly.
I think the thing with Night Trap and Mortal Kombat and Doom is that the progression of graphics in video games moved much faster than I think people
were ready for.
Yeah, we're ready for, because, you know, you go from Pong to Scorpion ripping a guy's skull and spinal cord out, you know, in the span of like 10 years.
Yeah, and the first instance was, I think, Death Race, according to Wikipedia, which is like a bunch of dots, and some of the dots resemble people, and you run over people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so abstract that I don't think people fully connected them. They could recognize that violence was a problem, but like, what does it fucking mean? And then you see live action images of people and they're edited or whatever. But then again, you look at film and there's nothing that video games of anything, even including Harvester, that hasn't been done in a fucking movie before, you know?
I think, like with comics, a lot of it comes back to the perception of the medium being primarily for children. And something like Mortal Kombat was initially an arcade game. So you could go there with little Billy to go play Joust or whatever, and you can't avoid the giant Mortal Kombat display and see the people talking about, like, oh my god, look, he ripped his skull and spinal cord out, you know? Just sometimes with that, it's not necessarily for me a thing of censorship, but like, maybe the game with all the violence on screen all the time should be like, you know, not quite so front and center in the arcade, but you know, whatever.
Well, I mean, okay, there's an element of this I want to bookmark for when we talk about, say, the ending to Harvester.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a part of it that I want to not talk about now. However, what I do want to say is that there's also a lot beyond violence. And I mean, yes. Also, okay, let's go for that first.
We're going to talk about Custer's Revenge.
We're going to talk about, not just that, but there are, you know, stereotypes, you know, we look at, I see on Wikipedia, it lists Punch Out, but like, I would say Postal is also a very clear example of people trying to be shocky and edgy and trying to be offensive. And Grand Theft Auto, I think there was a lot of talk over the hot coffee mod, but I think Grand Theft Auto also tried really hard to be offensive at multiple points and intentionally tried to shake people for the sake of money. I think that's one of the big things you'll see here is that by the 90s, I don't know how many movies could get away with being shocking. The only thing that I can think of is Blair Witch, and that's because of how quote unquote real it felt, even though it mm-hmm. didn't feel very real. But like, you look at Grand Theft Auto or some of these games or Mortal Kombat, they partially sold themselves on being shock factor. You gotta come see this. You've never seen a game do this before.
Yeah. And like, the one that comes to mind when we like slotted on this as the Variety Minute was, I remember the 2015 game Hatred that was on Steam. It was like a mass shooter simulator, and it was like the CEO was accused of being like a neo-Nazi, and I don't really remember how that like came, like whether that like bookended or whatever, but and it's just about being a mass shooter. You get points for shooting civilians, and the protagonist says things like, the only thing I hate worse than politicians are the people that vote for them. And you, like, cause a nuclear holocaust at the end. You know, and it's so over the top and silly, and no one should have given it the time of day. But also, it's, you know, how many games are there where the goal is to be a mass shooter? And so, it kind of like Harvester, our main topic, it was made to get that Streisand effect of controversy sells. And it worked.
Well, not just that, but it's also like, this goes into a big, broad topic of First Amendment stuff, but those things have to be okay for the First Amendment or creativity or any art mm-hmm. to matter. Like, obscenity has to kind of exist and be allowed to exist. Every time you see, like, oh, Doom exists, oh, Doom Doom encouraged Columbine, right? You saw mm-hmm. that. Most of those times, every time there was in the news, a game developer or, first of all, a lot of them would cut back and heavily censor themselves to the point of absurdity, or they would go the other end. Like, I remember after one of them, there were, like, indie mass shooter. There was, like, a Flash game mass shooter game that came out. Like, mm-hmm. after one of them. And then also, if you look at, like, say, Newgrounds, one of the first Newgrounds characters was Pico. And Pico was a mass shooter.
Yeah.
And these things, they have to exist, even if they're made by bad people and have awful content. It's sort of like flag burning, where it's like, you have to be able to do it, because if you can't do it, there's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just... everything is good when it's done well, right? I think that's... I think that's the take I'll go with. You know, there's... I don't know if we'll keep this... There's an old joke about comedians where even, you know, the best comedian can make even rape funny, but only when it's Elmer Fudd and Porky Pig. You know? And sometimes that's how it is with video games, where it's like, you know, I see... Honestly, this Wikipedia list of most controversial games is kind of milquetoasted, a lot of it. You know, when we're talking about people that want to make controversial games, controversial art, the thing it truly needs is a clear statement of purpose. Because, you know, the comedian who says the N-word in order to shock and provoke and expose the phoniness and hypocrisy of censored language quickly attracts an audience of people that want to say the N-word because they believe in what it means, you know? And that just kind of tends to happen with games like Mass Shooter Simulator 2015 and stuff.
Let me ask you, I actually have something that's like pretty contributive here. Did you ever see, when Donald Trump was first elected in, you know, 2017, he saw a reel of, I don't know who brought it to him, but he saw a reel of violent video games. And a lot of it was very out of touch and minor. And it's so funny to see like a Dead by Daylight Maury in there. And I guess it is like, oh yeah, this is pretty violent. And if you don't play video games, you would be kind of shocked that people play this. But like also seeing it, it's like, oh, that's the best you got. Like it's so weird how desensitized we are at points, but also speaks to like a lot of it is also in cartoony slapstick. Like, when you mentioned Mortal Kombat or when we mentioned Grand Theft Auto, all of it's cartoony. And when we talk about Harvester, the violence can't be taken seriously almost ever. You know what I mean? Or Doom Eternal. You can't play Doom Eternal and take its violence seriously, even though it's pretty grotesque at points. Because there's slapstick in it, and it plays with itself, you know?
I remember, was it Sandy Peterson who was shocked that Doom was controversial because of the satanic imagery, and he was like, the demons are the bad guys. Yeah, you're a holy crusader purging the demons. How do we feel about controversies that are not necessarily about content, but controversial for, I don't know, business practice? Because that does make up a big chunk of this list, is stuff like Dragon's Dogma 2 having a ton of microtransactions at launch for stuff that you can easily earn in game and things like that. Like, does that pass the controversy bar for you, or is it two different animals?
I think it does. I think this is where my cynical self kicks in. Is a lot of this you can't control, and a lot of this doesn't fucking matter. With adult content, a lot of this, okay, I'm trying to think of the way to structure this to where it sounds coherent. When we talked about the adult content or graphic content, I would say 80% of it doesn't mean anything, even when they were taking it seriously with legislation. Half of it is politicians leaning towards making people feel better, like making parents feel better. And again, I'll end it on there because I want to talk about that later. But when we talk about business practices, you can't stop microtransactions. Or if we could, we should have done it 15 years
a while ago.
Yes. Yeah. To quote the horse armor conversation again. Or another one is DRM. I think DRM is... It's not a losing battle, because I think that's one where it clearly affects normal consumers. Like, DRM practices often harm the actual purchasers more than the pirates. So then what the fuck is half the point of it? Or always online practices. Half this shit makes me not want to buy your game. So then developers and publishers especially are trying to figure out the way to sneak these things in and make the customer happy as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I think the first controversial game that I was there for the controversy, was, like, the ending of Mass Effect 3, you know, for better or worse. I remember, like, the meltdown that happened because of that. And it is listed here on the list of controversial games because of that fan meltdown. And it's kind of like where, you know, part of me does want to be like, oh my god, those nerds, video games aren't real. But on the other side, I'm like, yeah, you know what? That ending did really suck overall, and it is a black mark against the game. The same way that, like, including some unnecessarily shocking or controversial element in another kind of game probably would be a black mark against it. You know, everything within context, right?
Yeah. There's some I want to talk about here. There's actually quite a bit here. All right, I'm going to go ahead and say, I think this is the most valid form of controversy, where you're sort of talking about the content within and sort of wondering about intent. I'm just going to go ahead and ask you, just, you've played the Resident Evil game, Smurf. How do you feel about Resident Evil 5? Like, do you feel like, yes, this is racist? Because I do. This is racist.
The great Resident Evil 5 question. Because Resident Evil 4, the original, is not kind to rural Spanish villagers, you know?
No, it's not.
Leon famously says, I'm surprised they even know about indoor plumbing.
Yes.
So, you know, is it a game about shooting Africans, or is it a game about being in Africa and there's a zombie outbreak, right? And I think the fact that Resident Evil 5 goes the direction of, it's not just that they become zombies, but they, like, revert into this tribalistic mindset of, like, painting their bodies and using spears and doing war whoops, that it starts to, you know, would this be out of place in some sort of, you know, propaganda about purging the Dark Continent or what
have you. Not just that, but especially... It's specifically the tribal element, and, like, when Chris and Sheva steal treasure from, like, tribal areas and sort of plunder, that you can't help but make colonialism comparisons, and it sort of leads into fantasy, like, a fulfillment fantasy, and you're like, this is very upsetting. I don't know. That's where it definitely leans into it for me. Like, I would say the first portion of the game isn't great, but, like, in a remake, I'd be like, yeah, if it's, like, reinterpreted well enough, I'm like, eh, this is fine. But, like, as it stands, I'm like, I totally...
I'm willing to believe that Resident Evil 5 was a misstep rather than anything of, like, hateful intent, I think. You know, never assume malice where sufficient ignorance can also be the answer, you know?
And We fucked up choosing this category, Murph, because this is just hot water everywhere.
It's filling in. It's around my ankles.
Yes. Yeah. You could. You're the frog about to feel the boil, or the lobster. I forget which one that is. But
I come in with the Dragon's Dogma hot takes, and now the controversy hot takes.
Okay. All right. I'm just gonna. Maybe I shouldn't. Okay. No, I do want to say it. How do you feel? Let's look at Street Fighter or Punch-Out. And, okay, actually, let's just do Street Fighter. Okay, you want to make a fighting game that covers multiple cultures and diversity, and you make one Jamaican guy, or you make a sumo wrestler.
Yeah.
At what point are you doing offensive stereotypes to convey harmful ideas, or at what point are you celebrating a culture? You know what I mean? That's a very fine line. And I would say Harada of Tekken recently, I think about 6 months ago, it was before the Tekken 8 thing, showed concern about that. He was like, I don't know what is the easiest way to do that. I think that's a very tough line for developers to walk.
I think it's kind of something where a lot of these characters start from a place of stereotype, like, oh, we need a sumo wrestler archetype character, or we need a capoeira archetype character, you know, for like Eddie Gordo in Tekken. And then down the line, you know, because that might be that sole bit of representation, Eddie may be like the only Brazilian game character some Brazilian kids have ever seen. He becomes beloved and adopted within the community. You know, we see this a lot with like video game heroines that were like just there as eye candy originally, like Lara Croft, you know, there as made to be and pushed forward as a sex symbol, now reclaimed by women in like, you know, the modern day, and is now this you know, true dyed in the wool like heroine and a video game icon, you know, because there's that recontextualizing and that reinterpretation to make her more, you know, palatable, for lack of a better word. And I think that can come up with characters that, you know, like Punch-Out, you know. What is King Hippo? He's from parts unknown, but I know the one of my Samoan friends in university was like, I love King Hippo. He was the first time I felt seen on screen as a big guy that could kick people's asses, you know? And it's just like, there will always be people on both sides. You know, there are people that are going to say, I feel stereotyped by this. This does not represent me. And then the other side being like, yes, I feel seen.
Hey there, Editor Bro here, and I'm on a time limit for recording this little bit. Got probably like 45 seconds tops. Okay, so I wanted to mention that I think there is a sliver of hope or ways to improve for this specific issue. I think the important thing is like, let's look at like consulting work, where you can be able to hear, or like focus groups specifically for these audiences or specifically for these cultures. Consulting work especially has informed opinions and informed perspective on these like this cultural sensitivity, and it allows people that like of these specific cultures to have jobs in an industry that may preclude them from it, or like may exclude them. So I feel like consulting is a way to have your cake and eat it too. It's not the end all be all, and sometimes a company will hide behind that instead of actually listen to the voice. But I think with a voice that's heard, it lends authenticity and makes it more appropriate, even if you're still going to have a conflict, as Murph says at the end of the day.
Yeah. That's a much more complicated conversation than actual violence. It feels like the bulk of controversy, at least in terms of legal stuff, or at least like how the mainstream feels about controversy in video games, is about violence. And I do think there is a conversation to be had about the glorification or what have you of the violence. But I think there are some points that I feel are good, and I feel are artistically important. Let me ask you, there's one more that I wanted to ask you about. Did you play Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2?
I only played Modern Warfare 1.
Do you know what I'm about to say?
I think so. I believe so. Are you about to say me, remember no Russian?
Yes. So I think in moments like that where, first of all, the player is given the option to skip it. And I think that is super important to say, is I feel like optional ways to turn off or remove the content, optional, not state enforced, is, I think, the happy medium where if you don't want your child or if you don't personally want to see these triggering things, having it be an option to just skip or alter slightly, I think is probably the best of both worlds. And the level itself, I think, was meant to be upsetting. I don't know. I don't know the best answer for it, but I know that the scene should probably stay in. I don't know if it showed up again in the remake. I have no idea.
I mean, it's a storytelling moment. And like you said, it is there to be shocking. I think... I'm trying not to come across too centrist on any of this, but it context truly does matter. You know, I think about, like, all the pieces of media that were edited after 9/11 to, like, remove the Twin Towers from the skylines of, like, Spider-Man and things like that. Yeah. And then you have more absurd examples like, oh, we can't have, I forget what movie it was, but it's like there's a scene with a plane and they cut out the scene with the plane because they thought the plane would bring, like, just the idea of planes would trigger people thinking about 9/11, you know? And it's like that it's just the context matters, and thinking about the level you are going to scrub and avoid controversy, I think, gets into a worse area in some circumstances.
Especially when if it's artistically valid, then there's an elephant in the room, and censoring the elephant in the room makes things 10 times worse. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I think we may be talking in circles at this point. Do you want to go ahead and go into the game of the week?
Yeah, let's find out how much of a kidder you have been, Brogan.
Only those who seek enlightenment will want my attention. Even memory is illusory, a chemical imprint on meat that must one day decay. The human mind always seeks to categorize phenomena. If you're interested in reviving the decaying corpse that is your memory, what is at issue is whether in answering the question, you will find the answers you seek. Only initiates may enter the hall of the Order of the Harvest Moon. You always have a choice, initiate. Which choices you make matter only to you. Whatever occurs in here is relevant to the great question, which you cannot help but answer.
All right. Our game of the week is Harvester. Released in 1996, Harvester is the brainchild of writer-director Gilbert P. Austin. Austin knew that his game company Future Vision was floundering and needed a big game to draw attention from industry giants at the time. Knowing that his company couldn't necessarily make quality, he decided to go all in on controversy and make a game so shocking that the public had to take notice of it. The game itself is a traditional point-and-click with some combat, using digitized actors and assets a la early Mortal Kombat. The story follows Steve, a young man who awakens in the 1950s town of Harvest, with no memory of who he is or how he got there. The town of Harvest is filled with off-kilter characters ranging from sinister to downright goofy, but all of them are pressuring Steve to join the Lodge of the Harvest Moon, which looms large on the horizon and will carry the secrets to the questions he has. The game is fully Joker-fied, as much of the dialogue lampoons American stereotypes and talks about the hypocrisies of society, namely, our approach to controversial art. Often the player is given an unsaid choice between solving a puzzle or just killing townspeople to get what you want. Because, after all, you always were a kidder, Steve. So, Brogan, with that all in mind, what did you think of Harvester?
I liked the game a lot. I don't know if I love it. However, I think it may be the best statement on video game violence I have seen. So I think that matters the most. And
I kind of feel the same way.
Yeah. I feel like I'm trying to think of the short way to say it so we can swing it to you. But I would say that I think most of my problems with the game are in actual brick-by-brick game design, particularly the combat itself, which starts to matter near the end. And then I think with the humor and how it's shaped, you know, I feel like the elements where it's just sort of satirizing jingoism and early 1950s, 60s Red Scare America, I feel like those are inspired well enough and good, but definitely humor we've seen before. But where it's really sharp is in terms of the absurdity. You said that this was ahead of its time in terms of humor, and I particularly see that with how it edits or how it does some sort of nonsensical character moments, such as a character being obsessed with meat or your baby sister. Things like that, mm-hmm. where I am definitely seeing a lot of, like, Tim and Eric or something to that effect influence, where it's like, oh, this is, like, crazy ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm. I originally came to this game, because if you're in the point-and-click sphere, you know about Harvester, because it's kind of one of those cult classics and, like, so bad it's good, but also weirdly controversial games. It's shocking, you know? And I originally came to this game because I was like, I had gotten my Scum VM engine set up to do some good old point-and-click emulation. And I was like, what are some must-play games from the 90s? And Harvester kept coming up, but only if you can stomach it, you know? And I'm like, ooh, I like to stomach things. And I played it, and I was just I didn't get far when I played it by myself, and I was just kind of mildly in awe of it, and then kind of forgot about it until I started seeing all these video essays and Let's Plays pop up of Harvester. Like, I know Pavlos, when I mentioned to him we were playing this, he said I should watch the Let's Play Retsupre did back in the day of it. And I know, like, the Game Grumps played through Harvester quite recently and things like that. And it seems to be a game that is very engaging to watch because getting, like, the reaction of it is, you know, everyone's going to react to it in a very different way, whether they're like, oh my god, that's shocking, or man, these effects are goofy, or what's with these line reads. And I genuinely think if this was released today as is, and it was just like this weird throwback indie game, I think it would be getting like rave reviews, you know?
I think it would place in the same area as Cruelty Squad.
Hmm. Yeah. I can definitely see that, where it's just kind of so overwhelming, but also there's, like, this just undercurrent of, like, is this all one big shit post and the joke is on me? Or is there, like, does Harvester actually say something, you know?
And I think it does, and I think it's effective in that. We'll get to that later. I think there should be a spoiler section. I want to talk about the actual adventure game elements. I think that is a great place to start. It's a good spectator game because the story is allowed to unfold and you can see the beats and you're not frustrated by the puzzle elements. And this game is actually pretty easy or forgiving regarding its adventure game puzzle elements. First of all, as long as you don't murder anybody, and there are some people you're allowed to just straight up murder, period, there's like a jail system where you're able to be forgiven and be like, oh, it's okay, instead of like an immediate death that you would see in like a King's Quest or something where it's like, oh, I fucked that up. It's only a fuck up if it was very clearly you couldn't get out of a situation. Like, if you didn't leave a burning building, you would die. But otherwise, you will go to jail. And to me, that is completely reasonable and makes 100% sense. And then I feel like the moments themselves, I think especially starting the first day, was really, really nice visiting all the townsfolk and seeing their unique characterizations. Even the characters that don't matter, like the wasp lady or the dude that has no legs and is like a jingoistic military guy that can nuke the place. Yeah. Both of them are still really, really memorable. This place is so convenient because all of the areas are easily memorable. So that really helps with navigation.
If you're following a walkthrough, you actually miss out on a sizable bit of like content in the game, because there are some areas that you just flat out don't need to go to, but you go to them to get, like, you know, the message of the game. Like, you know, you don't need to go to the TV station whatsoever, but if you go there and talk to the cowboy actor and he goes off on this screed about how violence is okay when it's being done to godless heathens and stuff like that, then, like, you know, you get more of the themes and stuff going on. And yeah, as far as, like, the adventure game logic, there's a few bits where I think the clarity could have been better. Well, one example that comes to mind is when you need to break into your dad's bedroom, because things are happening in there and the door is locked. And, you know, it's very clear. It's very clear from the beginning, like, outside your house, there are bars on the window. And you inspect the bars and it says, oh, they're fastened with a Phillips head screwdriver. And you, okay, I've got a Phillips head screwdriver. And you unlock it and you go inside and an alarm gets tripped and you get sent to jail and executed, you know? And what you're supposed to do is get a dolly from another person's house, from their garage, and use it on a china cabinet to reveal an alarm system that you can then turn off. And I think there could have been a bit more clarity there, like maybe have a wire running from the china shelf to the door, or when you inspect the china shelf, have the description mention that you see, like, this blinking light behind it, because you can kind of see it, but the visual clarity's really fuzzy because the resolution of a lot of these areas is low. It's not always clear what you're supposed to interact with. And if you're playing it blind, there's just a lot of instances of swiping the mouse over the screen and seeing what prompts, like an inspect or pickup prompt.
Oh, absolutely. And you also typically will have to inspect and then click the thing again to actually pick something up, which is slightly annoying at times. The visual clarity of the backgrounds is probably the biggest problem. I mean, that's always an issue with adventure games. The logic is also at points kind of, I think it is a production issue. So for instance, I don't know if you saw this in your production notes or whatever, but the wasp lady originally was meant to, and this is something that I messed up on initially, was she was supposed to be more involved. There was a moment where you were supposed to burn her house down to distract the firemen for the bolt of fabric mission. And instead, what you're supposed to do is flip the fire alarm at the school to distract them to get the stuff. And then later on, you could go in. Obviously, you have to do the meat thing to get the dog, etc., etc. But otherwise, that was one of the things you were supposed to do. And I was signposted earlier by them saying the wasp lady's house was a fire hazard. So I figured, oh, these two things should go together. There's times like that where I feel like it was just a misstep in how production worked. But otherwise, I feel like the game is pretty clear in the things. And it also helps that, like, there's not a lot of items. And a lot of the items you get very clearly matter in specific moments. That really helps. So, like, you'll get healing items. But, like, in terms of currency or whatever, that day one, you're pretty much going to get, like, two or three things. And those two or three things are going to really be obvious. Like, oh, I need to give the old guy this dirty magazine. He makes it very obvious to me, and it's literally the only thing I can buy. So
yes.
So all of those elements really help to make things. I think when it gets to the later segments, it's kind of rough, but it's nice that once you go into the lodge, there's actually multiple ways to progress. So that helps too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's like a first half and second half of this game. First half, you're in the town interacting with the townspeople and sort of doing these missions to get initiated into the lodge. Once you're in the lodge, your inventory gets wiped. You can't go back to the town, and you're sort of dealing with these surreal tableaus. these quote-unquote mysteries, and it kind of, in a few ways, becomes a dungeon crawler, and that's where the combat really comes in, and I would say, more than the clarity of the backgrounds, the combat is the worst part of the game.
Absolutely. It's bad.
It's holding right mouse button and hoping you out-damage the damage you're being dealt.
And like, the complexity comes in, really, with how long your reach for your melee is, so the scythe is probably your best bet. Or, there's, like, some items that are have consumable ammo, so we're talking the nail gun and the shotgun, and you should save those till the end. So
you really should, because you gotta fight the wizard.
Yeah, you're gonna get your shit kicked in otherwise. So, I mean, it's rough. That's all I'm gonna say on it, you know.
Yeah, the game is rough, but it's a charming roughness. You know, it feels like something a person made, rather than something, you know, even though the backstory of the game is the creator wanted to make something controversial to draw attention, to the point where even, like, there was, like, a hearing on controversial games, you know, Mortal Kombat, Night Trap. He, like, started, like, calling his representatives to say, you know, you need to get this game Harvester on that list as well. That game's more shocking than either of those. But at the same time, you know, the clarity of purpose in the writing and the themes is just, like, so clear and apparent. There's nothing, like, muddy about that.
No. Everything has its own purpose. And I do like the lodge, particularly in the last segment where you're going to different rooms and the rooms have different themes and messages to them. I think what's really nice about this game's commentary on violence is how comprehensive it is in touching all the different elements. It talks about the American culture and the attitudes, and it helps that the TV segment and the news segment all sort of morph into the commentary itself. I want to save a little bit of it for the plot twist. When do you want to go into spoilers?
In a bit. I think we can edge into that by talking about the live action elements of the game.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah. What I really like is the particular line delivery. This reminds me a lot of a David Lynch thing, where
it is very Lynchian.
It's very Lynchian, where there's, like, there's a spotlight on how eccentric the townspeople can be. And it's nice that there's also this clear artificiality to it, and they call it out initially. Honestly, you want to know my first thought when I was playing this, because I was playing it blind, was I thought we were, like, I did think we were in a simulation. I thought we were in a simulation by aliens. Because there's a lot of alien signposting in the beginning of the game. Particularly, like, when you go into
the barbershop.
And then the bride-to-be Stephanie's kitchen. There's, like, the beer. Wee-hoo! Like, some of the music is very, like, 50s sci-fi. And those all play together really well. I like the absurdity of a lot of it. Each character has, like, this own absurd logic to them, and it makes the horrific elements pop a lot. So, for instance, on night two, Mr. Potsdam buries the little girl. I forget her name.
Karen.
Yes. And, yeah, he buries Karen, and he buries her alive. So the first day, if you dig her up, she will be much more robotic, but that's sort of to simulate trauma. Like, she's very traumatized because bad things happen to her, I guess is the nice way to say it.
Yes.
And that is really, really effective. And it all works. I like how the performances feel stiff and amateurish, but serve the functions of what's needed.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, it has this uncanny feeling to it with a lot of the line reads. And I don't think, like, the voice acting and performances in this are bad, because it kind of feels like what it needs to be. Like, Steve's voice actor and his performance actor are two different people. And the voice actor is kind of like infamous for these really wonky line reads, you know, where he's like natural causes and things like that. But like, that's so memorable to me. Like Steve feels like a video game icon, yeah. Like, 'cause there's nothing else like him out there. And when I was saying like this game was ahead of its time with its like how it presents itself, like the actual FMV cutscenes, it very much is like a Tim and Eric skit where it's like if you do a crime, but it's like a minor one, like breaking and entering, the sheriff will drive you home, tuck you in, and kiss you on the forehead goodnight.
Yes.
You know?
That's very like, that's, Tim and Eric, yes.
That's just funny, man, you know? Yeah. And stuff with like the absurdity of the violence. In the lodge you do this chess game with the chess master. You can choose to fight him or do like a chess problem where you have to mate him in a couple of moves. And if you do the puzzle and get it right, it just hard cuts to a scene of him smashing his own face in with an axe. And it's like, you know, me when I lose at chess once, but it's, I don't know. I can't really say it's shocking because I think it is supposed to be like intentionally funny in a lot of ways.
Especially like, okay, prior to the lodge, I would say the most shocking moments for me was when you see the dad and when you, one of the scenes where the baby loses her eyes or her yes. eyes pop out. Those are the two scenes where I was like, whoa. Otherwise I was like, eh, it's fine. I didn't murder people casually though. So that's probably a big thing.
You do kind of miss out if you do, murder, but you have you're blackmailing the sheriff, so he lets you off. You get one get out of jail free. You do miss a line of dialogue where he asks you how it was, and you can either say I liked it or it made me sick. And if you're like it made me sick, you get this really chilling line of dialogue where he's like, the corn has ears, son, and that's not what the corn wants to hear. You know,
that's a great transition. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, if we want to get into the spoiler section, like, what is Harvest actually about?
So I guess I'll open because this was completely new to me. The spoiler is that it is a simulation to raise serial killers. And everyone in the game is fake. I think what I really liked about it is there's also other signposts. Like, there is, like, I forget what the car's name is, but there is one type of car. Yeah, the Tucker that everyone drives. There's literally only 48 of them fucking made. So it's very suspicious. And Steve even goes, that's so weird because when I was growing up, I always wanted a Tucker. That's supposed to be a huge hint. And Stephanie is also like the only person in the game that like also is like, no, something's fucked up here. So you're vibing with her. And it sort of develops into like a yes, this simulation is meant to raise, and then they want you to kill Stephanie. At the end of the game, you get to Stephanie, and you can either A, save her, and then have a fake Matrix life in this shitty computer simulation where everything is fake, but you can live with another human being and have a lifetime and raise a kid. Or you can murder her and go back to the real world and be a serial killer. Those are your two options for endings.
All the violence, all the grotesquerie, all the mysteries of the lodge are meant to desensitize Steve to violence so that when it comes to killing a real person, it doesn't even faze him.
I will go ahead and say what I think is the beautiful part of this satire. Again, I think if you were to analyze with a video essay, you could break down bit by bit each character, location, each room in the fucking lodge to sort of discuss how violence is portrayed in it. I think that's a very complex and fulfilling subject. But what really works for me is in the serial killer ending, the actual ending is your mom comes into Steve's room and is like, Steve, what game are you playing? And he's like, oh, I'm playing that Harvester game. And she's like, you should not play that game. That game's really, really violent. Violence causes, violence in real life. And he's like, no, it doesn't, Mom. And it's like, oh, it's just like your Roadrunner cartoons. They edited those Roadrunner cartoons. He's like, Roadrunner cartoons?
And then the camera zooms in way too much.
And the camera zooms in way too much. I think that is the big thing that we haven't spoken about in the past hour, is it's not so much the actual content, because a lot of times the actual content of works is fulfilling and artistically merit and does not literally cause violence. What causes violence is people, and people that enable things. So a Steve hiding in his room and gratifying his urges with something, and then a mother who is inattentive and does not pay attention to the behavior of her child, that's what causes violence. And that's what mm-hmm. enables violence. And it is not Harvester the game. And it is the culture of America. It is how we raise children.
I think, like, the most on-the-nose thing, I say on-the-nose, but it's also something you can, like, just miss, is when you, if you choose to kill Stephanie, and you kill her, the price to exit the lodge is the same to get in, a skull and spinal cord. And if you kill Stephanie, Steve rips out her skull and spinal cord, he does the pose, he does the Sub-Zero pose, and there's, like, you know, a deep-voiced, like, omniscient being who might as well say fatality, you know? And it's just one of those things where it's, like, you can't really criticize it because, in a way, the game accounts for it, and it's just, like, it's in dialogue with you as you're criticizing it. Like, you know, there's the art gallery, and the curator there is like, you know, the issue with grotesque things is that you can't forget them. And so in that way, aren't they the truest art of all? And things like that. It's like just constantly like, oh yeah, I know what you're going to say here. Here's the counter argument. And it's not always like sufficient. Like, I think there's a lot of waffling back and forth in things where it's like, you know, one of the levels of the lodge is a whorehouse. And you can have a conversation with the madam there, and she's like, well, you shouldn't be, like, admonishing sex workers. They're filling a role in the, like, economy, you know? But also, if you sleep with one of the women there, you get an STD and slowly die, you know?
Well, to tie back into what I said about the Looney Tunes enabling thing, you can see this in how the mothers rear, or, like, how things are in the actual town itself. For instance, your brother consumes television. That's his primary mm-hmm. thing. That's literally all he does, is sit in front of the TV. Even when the TV goes out, even when the TV station's burnt down, he'd much rather fucking watch static on a screen than do anything else. Mm-hmm. And that is a scenario where that's also what enables this, because he is absorbing the culture. He's absorbing what you said earlier, the cowboy saying, as long as you hurt, you know, the native, you know, as long as you heard the engines, violence is a-okay. And mm-hmm. he's internalizing those harmful messages. It's those harmful messages that desensitize people rather than the content of what happens. You know what I mean? It's not the mm-hmm. violence itself. It's what the violence functions as.
Mm-hmm. It's a, you know, what's the old bit? It's like, if a dog bites a man, that's funny, but if a man bites a dog, that's abuse or something like that, you know?
Yeah, and again, like, especially when we consider video games as being relatively new for its time on release, I mean, you know, 20 years or whatever, and TV being an old mainstay, it's true, like, TV probably did way more damage in terms of violence and violent preconceptions for people than video games ever did. Mm-hmm. I would say television probably killed more people than video games. Probably.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just where we are with media and how people deal with media. I think there's certain moments in the game that also tackle subjects that are separate but adjacent. I'm surprised that there were some side quests or things that were unresolved, or at the very least had very lacking payoff. So for instance, the mortuary / like hotel thing, mm-hmm. you can like get the ledger and you could like kind of prove, or you could take a picture of a dead body and you can kind of prove that the mortuary guy is killing homeless vagrants every week to you know, bury them. But it doesn't really have, like, a real payoff. Like, the sheriff will ignore it. It's mostly to get the glue. And also, the mortuary guy is one of the few guys that you can kill scot-free for no reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that there may be a meta aspect to that, because the mortuary is played by the game's creator.
Yes.
So maybe it's like a thing of, like, he's the one with the power, he decides who lives and dies.
Yeah.
Or something like that. I would probably chalk it up to, like, the Wasp Woman being a thread that was left behind in production.
Yeah. But I do think, like, when it discusses these separate but equal elements that you're interested, or, like, with your dad, when your dad sort of talks about sex and violence, that's pretty much the main time sex is involved, other than when it's with Stephanie or some of the more disturbing, like, rape elements. Your dad is like, oh, let me talk to you about how violence is intertwined with sex. You gotta bring out the barbed wire on your marriage, on your honeymoon. You know what I mean? Like, I think those elements are really, really interesting. I don't necessarily know if they're fully executed well, but like you said, I remember it, so maybe it did.
Mm-hmm. It's just, it truly is something that I'm not going to forget. It's kind of, this episode is kind of like our No More Heroes of the season, in a way, where, yes, it has these issues with the actual gameplay and structure and things, but it's still a, you know, an animal too rare to live, too weird to die, you know? Like, and I think we see that Harvester's grip on the public consciousness of certain, like, niche parts of the horror community is really present. Like, you know, we have Molly Moon doing, like, TikToks where she's, like, doing this really stilted FMV, like, point-and-click horror thing. And things like that. I think people have really tapped into FMV as a tool for uncanniness for horror. And I think Harvester was really ahead of the curve on that.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I don't know. There's also, like, a lot of, like, charming aspects. I like how, like, for instance, I'm just going over random elements now. I like how the moms are all the same. It's very Stepford Wife, but doesn't go for like the pretty aspect, just goes for the cookie cutter aspect. I think it really works. Especially since they're so concentrated on the bake sale. There's some really good punchlines in this. Like, your mom makes, like, 1,200 cookies the entire week. And then you're like, okay, so how many cookies are you bringing to the bake sale? She's like, 20. Everything else is stale. And I think that, like, deliveries like that really work for me. It's a really fun game in terms of writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's just, I think it was unfairly... I think the devs genuinely shot themselves in the foot by leaning so much into being controversial and shocking and bloody and a gore fest. Because I think the writing is genuinely a bit sharp, and I would have liked to see what else Gilbert P. Austin would have come up with had his career kind of not ended with Harvester.
You know, I don't think there should be anything cut from this, though. I think in terms of subject matter, I think everything is good. Like, I think I wouldn't edit any of it out.
No, I don't think, because again, it's just on a level of absurdity. Like, when if you go around town just killing townspeople, like, their death animations are the most, like, oh my, I've been cleaved in twain and all of my organs are popping out like a can full of snakes, you know? It's just, it's really silly, and I think that's the game's strength and intent, to be really silly with the violence, because it's like, you know, is this really what we're going to put forth as the controversy, this so over the top it's cartoonish violence?
And I also like the interplay. I do think that even though the game is fake and is so clearly artificial, I like the dynamics between neighbors. I like how everyone has, like, a at least one direct relationship where someone likes somebody or someone hates somebody or someone is blackmailing somebody. The sheriff has multiple of these, but, like, it just really works in terms of that. And it also, like, So, like, for example, it speaks to those side elements, for instance, of, you know, American culture or whatever. So, like, for instance, when you buy the Dirty Magazine, the shopkeeper tells you, like, oh, hey, you know, I don't sell this Dirty Magazine to the old man deputy because he's married. But I think it's good for a healthy young man to do it, or else you become like a fireman. And I will say the firemen are probably leaning.
I would cut or change the firemen to a degree.
Thinking on it, yeah. Yeah, the firemen are probably the most offensive.
The joke is that they're gay.
Yes, and it's like very clear. Although I do like the model. I think the model.
The model is funny.
Yeah, the
model. The model is funny because you go into the fire station. The bit is you go into the fire station and the fire truck is pink and they're filet-men, you know, and they're just inside painting a male model rather than doing any fireman stuff. But if you go back there at night and you break in, the male model is still there under the sheet, and that's just funny.
Yeah, and it's also like I think that's so smart and. It's so crazy that this game, I think this is one way it was ahead of its time. Obviously, there were NPCs by this point in time, but in terms of understanding and lampooning NPC behavior, I feel like this is probably one of these, the first, where it was like, oh, yes, I am just going to sit here because this is my job. This is what I do. Mm-hmm. And, or, you know, I'm going to, you know, Stephanie says at one point, my mom told me some gossip today. It didn't feel like she was telling me gossip. It felt like she was telling me exposition, like giving me hints to something. And that is one of the ways where it's able to very clearly be like, this simulation is a video game and is very smart about pretending to be a video game in those ways. I really like that.
Mm-hmm. You know, talking about Dragon's Dogma, like I was earlier, with like the lack of variety of things NPCs say, each time you do something in the town of Harvest, you can go to every single NPC and they will have a comment and point of view on it. Like, you know, when the diner burns down, everyone will talk about, like, you know, the diner burning down and their perspective on it. And you can get like you can miss so many lines of dialogue if you're just following a walkthrough.
Absolutely. There's a part of it where you're meant to like live and breathe it a little bit, where you're supposed to enjoy. And I mean, like, the town itself is pretty small, so it's worth it to check it out most days. There are some days where you can like cram your mission in like two beats where it's like, oh yeah, I'm fucking done. But otherwise it's really, really good. I liked it. I don't know how much I love it. I do agree that this is probably the No More Heroes of this year for us, where it sits in a very peculiar spot on the Murph diagram. You know,
I would tell people to either play Harvester or watch a Let's Play, because, you know, setting aside the controversial elements and the shock value of the game, the game's just funny, and it's fun to watch people react to those moments. So it's just like, you know, it's worthwhile it for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Are we wrapping up?
Yeah. I think that, you know, you should, if you like this episode, you should go over to our YouTube channel. I just put up a little 10-minute video there called Murph Played Too Many Games, Volume 2, where I just talked about 5 indie games I played when I was away in Canada. And, you know, covering things like Forgive Me, Father, and Road Redemption, which is a really good game.
Mm-hmm.
And, Brogan, I have something to reveal to you.
What's up?
This cabin.
Wait one second, that Murph. Murph, we forgot to leave out the paper.
Oh, no. For Jimmy James?
Yeah, we forgot to leave the newspaper out for the newspaper boy. He's supposed to pick up the newspaper.
How will everything be Jake if we don't leave out the paper?
Oh, I know. What were you about to say, Murph?
I just wanted to say to you that I'm not real.
What?
This cabin of dreams you've been broadcasting from, everything since the reactor melted down on the satellite of dreams, you've been in stasis.
Oh, no.
And there's only 2 ways out. You can either take the red pill and have the next episode be on the Tetris effect. Or you can take the blue pill and have the next episode be on Pac-Man Championship Edition.
Both
of them will involve Abram from Backlog Banter.
How about I take both pills right now? Haha, fuck you.
Well, at the same time, whoa, I have no clue what's going to happen.
We're going to do a podcast on both of them. Fuck you, NPC Murph. I want real Murph back. And then, okay. and then we play out. That's,
yeah,
that's...
and then we play out. Like this.
The extensive lore is developed.
Yeah. Yeah. In a tight 90 minutes.